You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I am Markus Hippi. On today's show, Russian President Vladimir Putin gives his first statement on the crisis in Crimea. Daniela Pellet of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Alessia Batalano of the Department of War Studies at King's College London will assess what he said. Also ahead. With 100 days to go until Brazil hosts this year's FIFA World Cup, we'll assess the state of the preparations as Carnival continues in Rio de Janeiro.
Brazil has been plagued with various problems. Stadiums have been delivered late in various cities, and then other infrastructure projects like transport links and so on have been delivered either late or won't be ready at all.
And before the end of the program,
everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lies.
We will bring you a review of the latest jazz releases. That is all to come on today's edition of Midori House with me, Markus Hippi, on Monocle 24. So, lots coming up here on Midori House during this hour. But before all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry, who's just arrived in Kiev, has condemned Russia's act of aggression in Ukraine and said Moscow, which has taken control of the Crimea region, was looking for a pretext to invade more of the country. He announced an economic package and technical assistance for Ukraine in a show of support for its new government amid escalating tensions with Russia. The European Union's foreign policy chief Catherine Ashton had previously held out the threat of sanctions against Russia if Moscow failed to withdraw its troops from Ukraine, while offering to mediate between the two alongside other international bodies.
We call on Russia to immediately withdraw its troops to the areas where they are permanently stationed on the basis of the agreement for the Black Sea Fleet stationed in Ukraine. We also call on Russia to agree to the request of Ukraine to hold consultations and to take part in urgent consultations amongst all signatories and adherents of the Budapest Memorandum of 1994.
Day two of the Paralympian Oscar Pistorius's murder trial adjourned on Tuesday at the Pretoria High Court, which saw more dramatic scenes in the court and three witnesses testify. The judge sharply warned the media to behave after a local television station leaked a photograph of the state's first witness, Michelle Berger, who had asked that her image not be broadcast. China beefed up security on Tuesday ahead of the country's annual National People's Congress. In the wake of the knife attack in Kunming that killed dozens and injured over 100, security was high in Beijing for the National People's Congress parliament session, with armed police patrolling and police vehicles parked in and around Tiananmen Square. Bo Shiyui is senior research fellow at the East Asian Institute of the National University of Singapore.
This NPC session is not going to be a major policy change forum. So I think these government deputies to the National People's Congress will be very, very, very cautious not to see anything different from the government official lines. So probably you won't hear much criticism of government policies, or, you know, probably you'll hear a lot about praises of Chinese new leadership's achievements in the past year.
Egypt's Foreign Minister Nabil Fahmy has reaffirmed his country's support on Tuesday for reconciliation between rival Palestinian factions after a court banned all Hamas activities in Egypt. Egypt has played the role of mediator in Palestinian reconciliation talks in the past, often hosting talks between Hamas and the Fatah party of the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. And the latest in a series of deadly winter storms has hit the US East Coast, with freezing rain, snow and near-record cold cancelling about 3,000 flights, shutting down the capital, Washington, D.C., and closing schools and local governments. Meteorologists say temperatures would be about 30 degrees Fahrenheit below normal as a cold front settled in from Great Plains to the Atlantic coast. But many residents decided to take advantage of the cold to meet up at Washington's National Mall to take part in an organized mass snowball fight.
Try not to get hit as much as possible, like I am now. I guess this makes me a little more of a target, but...
I was at home, my little brother was with me. It was his birthday yesterday, so I'm going to go have a snowball fight. So he said, let's go. I was like, all right.
My strategy is look at people who aren't wearing gloves, because they're probably not going to make the best snowball.
Definitely going to throw them at some people right now.
What? Everyone get two! Go in a straight line and we're going to march slowly at them.
Sounds like they're having fun, and that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan Wheatley. We will get more news headlines from Jonathan in 24 minutes. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:06 and it is 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Daniela Peled of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Alessia Pasolano of the Department of War Studies at King's College London. Welcome to the programme, both of you. The crisis in Ukraine has continued to move at a relentless pace. President Putin gave today his first press conference since the start of the Crimean crisis began. The president sat rather awkwardly in an elaborate gold chair and gave a fairly sprawling assessment of the events unfolding in Ukraine. This is how he summarized the ousting of Viktor Yanukovych.
The definition of what has happened in Kiev and in Ukraine as a whole, the definition could be the only one. It is an unconstitutional coup and a military seizure of power. Nobody is arguing with that.
That was indeed President Putin today in the press conference he gave. Alessia Pasolano, what are your first thoughts on that comment and of Putin's performance?
I thought it was extremely interesting the way he tried very hard to give a framework to his argument that was grounded on this idea that, this is an illegal act. What they've done is not right, it's illegally wrong, which in a way is implicitly trying to suggest, hence why we're stepping in. So is by doing that, is implicitly trying to provide an aura also of a justification, a sort of normative context within which his own actions can take place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an easy shot for Putin to take. I mean, there's certainly been a sense of irony failure about some of the statements coming out from the Americans, talking about how very dare the Russians violate the sovereignty of another country without due cause. But I think what I found interesting about Putin's speech is just how supremely relaxed he was, really, about all of this. He, he's saying, well, we'll host the G8 in June. If you don't want to come, you don't need to. We'll just be the G1. Fine. He's still sticking to this crazy narrative that the forces in Crimea have nothing to do with them. They had nothing to do with Russia. No. They're not wearing insignia on their uniforms, therefore nothing to do with Moscow. And of course, the military exercises are unconnected as well.
Let's talk more about those a bit later. Let's hear now what he thought what should have been the right approach to take in Ukraine.
The people obviously wanted changes, but you cannot encourage unlawful changes. As the post-Soviet space where all political structures are still very fragile, where the economy is weak and needs to follow the constitutional path only.
And on today's conference, President Putin also acknowledged the nature of the popular uprising, but stood firm to his view that, constitutionally speaking, Viktor Yanukovych remains Ukraine's head of state.
Legally, there is only one legitimate president. It's clear he doesn't have any power. That's understandable. I've already said this, and I want to repeat that the legitimate president, in purely legal terms, is, of course, Yanukovych.
So that was President Putin. And Daniela, you said earlier that you were surprised by how relaxed President Putin seemed when he was talking today in that press conference. Do you think he actually knows what he is doing?
That's a very, very good question. It's something I've been thinking about ever since this started, because it doesn't seem, unlike previous adventures like Georgia, for instance, there doesn't seem to be a beginning, a middle and an end to this. You know, and where is the exit route if he needs one? And I'm thinking today more so that it's also a case of sort of judging as he goes along what is the world's reaction and what are the consequences and how far he can get away with a particular strategy.
Alessia, what do you think about Putin's master plan? Is there one?
Well, I think he has very little room to manoeuvre. You see, I mean, first of all, I completely agree with you. I mean, he looked very comfortable, but then I could just turn around and say, like, if you were sitting in that kind of chair, wouldn't you? I mean, yeah, that's a very powerful statement. It looks very 19th century sort of powerful person talking. And there is something in the words that we just heard. He made a very specific reference to the fact that Ukraine belongs to this post-Soviet sort of context, in which implicitly, again, he's referring to the importance, the sense of also of paternalistic approach on behalf of Russia, you know, to monitor that things are just going the right way. And again, this goes back to this idea that there is very little room to maneuver. If you are making a statement, as Putin consistently and constantly is, about the importance of Russia, the role of Russia, and the influence that Russia has, we've seen this with other crises in the Middle East, how the Russians really are trying very hard to remind everybody else of their importance. Of course, if this is happening in the backyard, that is even more of a problem and really limits the options.
I mean, talk about it being in Russia's backyard, but from talking to Russians in recent days, I think a lot of people haven't quite absorbed the fact that Ukraine is an independent state. Georgia, okay, fine, they've made their peace with that. But Ukraine still, especially the Russian-speaking part, is still very much thought of as part of Russia. And perhaps Putin actually thinks this as well. It's not a question of invading someone else's of sovereignty or even trying to emphasize Russia's importance. This is where Russia has a right to act, is their attitude.
I think it's quite clear already that Putin's been gambling quite a lot with these actions. And does it seem for you that he actually would have taken into account all the consequences, also the financial consequences, the rubble plunging and so forth?
Well, I think there is certainly something to say here. That is, well, first of all, there is a clear connection. You know, Sevastopol, we were talking about this a little bit earlier. When you talk about Sevastopol has got enormous resonance. You know, in this country, there's lots of places that are named after the Crimean War. You know, Russia was there. Millions of Russians have died. So there is an element of there that there is a clear connection. You cannot just write it off too easily. That being said, I think that because of this, it was difficult, on top of your head, to just make a sort of a clear calculation as to all the potential consequences and outcomes. Also, we must remind ourselves that I think Russia, in particular Putin, considers that Russia is in a relatively strong position within Europe because of the important sort of reliance that European countries have in terms of energy and economic interactions in a wider sense with the country. So it's quite interesting, in fact, how the main sort of European state actors have had so far a relatively sort of a cautious response, highlighting the risks in the strategy and the movements that it was undertaking, but at the same time making a clear difference or signalling a clear difference of arguments, for example, in relation to the United States, which were a lot more sort of on a tough stance. Europeans were a lot more moderate. A part of it is because of the strong economic interdependence existing between Russian and Europeans.
Is Putin's statement enough to ease the waters? He didn't exactly rule out further military intervention.
Well, he didn't rule it out. He didn't rule it in. He doesn't need to. I mean, let's be clear about one thing. For all the rhetoric coming out now, my strong understanding is that the West has given up on Crimea. That's it. You know, Russia has won this part of the game. And I think really they're regrouping and thinking, just let them not go any further, because eastern Ukraine is a much trickier puzzle to solve.
Well, US Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Kyiv today to add his voice to the crisis, a day after British Foreign Secretary William Hague addressed the country's pro-European interim government. And this is some of what the US Secretary of State said earlier today.
In the hearts of Ukrainians and the eyes of the world, there is nothing strong about what Russia is doing. So it's time to set the record straight. The Russian government would have you believe it was the opposition who failed to implement the February 21st agreement that called for a peaceful transition, ignoring the reality that it was Yanukovych who, when history came calling, when his country was in need, when this city was the place where the action was, where the leaders of the nation were gathered in order to decide the future, he broke his obligation to sign that agreement. And he fled into the night with his possessions, destroying papers behind him. He abandoned his people and eventually his country.
So strong words from US Secretary of State John Kerry. But when we look at what the US can actually do, what do you think the real possibilities are?
I think the game here is not just about components of Ukraine. You know, it's not just about Crimea or not Crimea. I think there is a very fundamental question here about what this current situation and the crisis in the country is one that speaks about the question of human rights, the question of the reshaping of the social fabric, the restructuring of the social contract, how people in the country see themselves as a nation, as a country, and where do you go from here? I think the emphasis, and this is you know what Kerry is saying, is pretty much consistent across all the different international actors looking at the crisis. Here, what we're looking at is, hang on a second, we are certainly seeing Russian troops moving around, but let's not forget that this is all started with the people manifesting and manifesting their voices, their disagreement with the political establishment, and they wanting of change. You know, this is a very important thing, and I think one of the problems is that what is happening in Ukraine at the moment is something that, if you're in Russia, is not necessarily easy to understand. We're talking about democracy in the making, as it were, and not everybody has an answer to that. So you have to nurture, you have to be carefully trying not to sort of kill this important momentum of change that is happening in the country.
Yes, well, I hate to sound a note of cynicism here, but I don't know. I think Kerry's visit was so far kind of dripping with symbolism. You know, he lit a candle, he embraced people, he talked about, I mean, language about this is freedom, you know, I think, which seems already a bit out of date 10 years ago. And he promised them $1 billion. Okay, great. But all of this makes his predecessor, the Secretary of State's actions, look even more embarrassing at Clinton's famous let's press the reset button with Russia. It's a bit late now to try and change policy and change relations with Russia.
Danielle, you said earlier that your impression is that the West has already given up on Crimea. Well, Kerry said today that if Russia chooses to ignore appeals to pull back its forces, the US and its partners will have no choice but to seek to further isolate Russia politically, diplomatically and economically. Do you think this would happen?
Well, I think it's what he should be saying. I mean, you have to take a tough line, but realistically, what is Europe going to do? And it's very well for America to say we're going to put in place kind of swingeing sanctions. But Europe is recovering from a very punishing economic crisis. As we've just said, the trade ties with Russia are very deep. Is Britain going to say, oh, okay, no more banking ties? No, I mean, what has Britain said we'll do already? We're not sending a minor royal to Sochi this week for the Paralympics, and that's our approach. That's how tough we're actually being. Is Germany really going to endanger its trade ties? Russia is its biggest trading partner. Really, is this going to happen? I don't think so.
What do you think, Alessia?
Well, I think, at risk of sounding a little bit sort of conservative in this, I think that works two ways. You know, we've seen how the Russian currency plummeted in markets And all of a sudden a crisis that certainly presents an enormous amount of dilemmas for European actors and as well as the United States, because of course, you know, Daniel is absolutely right. You know, when all the chips are down, what are you going to be doing? Do you send troops in there? You have take military actions? You know, this is really unlikely. Nonetheless, the element of economic interaction, it doesn't work just one way, which is also one of the reasons why I believe Angela Merkel was trying to put an emphasis on the fact that they want to be engaged in this type of situation. When it comes down to economics, if things go bad, go bad both ways.
Let's talk about what Germany is going to do in a bit. We are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House. You're on Monocle 24 with me, Marco Sippi, Daniela Pellet and Alessia Patalano.
From cotton fields in Egypt to state-of-the-art laboratories in Bergamo, Monocle's film search for Made in Italy textiles focuses on the fifth-generation heritage firm Albini.
There is all this passion for excellence which come from our art, from our landscape. There is really a typical Italian way of seeing things with passion for what is beautiful. And we have this in our soul. When customers see Made in Italy, they really must be sure that behind there are all these values.
The Fabric Mill, part of our Italian industry special, now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Daniela Pellet and Alessio Patalano. We continue by talking about what Germany can do regarding the situation in Crimea. Interestingly enough, it seems that Germany is the one country that has been able to accomplish a relatively good connection with President Putin during this crisis. Chancellor Merkel spoke with him on the phone on Sunday, and Putin actually agreed to a proposal from Merkel to form a fact-finding mission to calm tensions with Ukraine. Have you heard anything more of that?
Well, at the moment, what we are seeing is certainly is there is currently and there is going to be a lot of behind the door type of communication, of which for the time being we probably hear very little about, because everybody has an enormous amount to lose in if the debate comes out in the wide open. As I said, this is a very much a situation in which at stake is not just Russian reputation or European energy security. We're talking about losses that in a situation where Europe is still quite fragile and in a way where Russia would have to back up and flex its muscles in order to go all the way. There's a lot more to lose in it. So for the time being, I think there is a continuous series of negotiations that will go on in a way also to buy time and see how Ukrainian people are going to go about with the current situation.
Moving on to another player in the crisis, one of the most vocal players, as a matter of fact, in this crisis is NATO. Its Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen gave this statement on the crisis yesterday.
We support Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty. We support the rights of the people of Ukraine to determine their own future without outside interference. And we emphasize the need for Ukraine to continue to uphold the democratic rights of all people and ensure that minority rights are protected. Ukraine is our neighbor, and Ukraine is a valued partner for NATO. We urge all parties to urgently continue all efforts to move away from this dangerous situation. In particular, I call on Russia to de-escalate tensions.
NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen there. Interestingly enough, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, and Russia has long complained of the organization's encroachment on its borders. So what exactly does NATO hope to achieve by intervening in the crisis?
I think we're a long way from any kind of intervention. I mean, there's one thing that would be guaranteed to be seen by Russia as a major escalation, and that's NATO involvement. I think Russia thinks that NATO exists just merely as a provocation to it. The rather wonderfully named General Philip Breedlove, who's NATO's European commander, said that there were no military plans. And it would be very hard to imagine a scenario in which there are NATO military plans. This isn't Libya. You know, I don't think NATO wants to get involved. There isn't a threat of a security vacuum. You know, the quarter of a million Tatars in Crimea are not about to be recruited by Al-Qaeda. So how far is NATO going to go with this? I mean, Russia is serious in as far as military action goes. I don't think that Russia will blink when it comes to that. But NATO's involvement? Really?
Exactly. What exactly should or can NATO do if we are looking at how this crisis can be solved? Military options may be out of question, but what else can it then be except for something on the level of statements like the one we just heard?
I think that the statement already is quite important because it's emphasising, it's putting the right emphasis, I believe, on where the imminent, the sort of the immediate action has to be taken. The statement that we just heard put a strong emphasis on the behaviour, on reducing the tension and not creating instances for provocations. I think that is absolutely dead correct. We've seen it today in the way the behaviour of the Ukrainian soldiers in the face of Russians pointing their guns at them. They were unarmed and they kept walking on. They know that they are playing on home territory and restraint is essential. You know, it's absolutely commendable the way they behaved so far in expressing that restraint because, of course, they know that the world is watching. And that is an important element in this story. You know, this kind of statement does help keeping the spotlight precisely on the right strategic leverage point. You know, if the Russians are under the spot, if President Putin has to come out and make a statement about creating some sort of legitimacy to what they're doing, it means that the right sort of elements are at work insofar as the situation goes at the moment.
Alessia Batalano and Daniela Pellet, NATO may be attempting to play a significant role here, but let's have a look now at some of the other Western powers who are involving themselves. We spoke a short while ago about Germany and its interest in the crisis, but both the UK, which was the first G8 country to pull out of the preparations for the summit in Russia this year, and France have considerable interest in stabilising the situation. UK Parliament has been debating about the situation again today, but a photo of documents actually suggests that despite all the rhetoric, the UK may be unlikely to launch any concrete action against Russia in order to protect the city of London. Does this surprise you?
No, it doesn't, because in a way one has to be responsible about the extent to which you can push a particular argument or a particular line of thought. Well, first of all, I think it is important to clarify that I just find, you know, I do walk around. I mean, not that I'm trying to claim that my papers are very important, but I do walk around with papers, and someone were to take a snapshot of, you know, the top cover or something I'm carrying, it doesn't mean that I'm actually getting everything that is in it. So that's the first point to make. What we're talking about is about pictures of documents as they were moving around, so we don't know what the full file looks like. And the FCO, as all other departments of government, they have to look at this a situation comprehensive fashion, assessing as the situation evolves the limits and the boundaries you can push against the cost for doing that. So for the time being, it seems to me that it's very important to keep a certain situation under control because there are important financial implications.
And also the financial connections between Germany and Russia, for example, 6,000 German companies are actually working in Russia, and France has a big military interest with Russia when it's selling weapons to Moscow and so on. So when we're looking at all these European countries and how they've been acting in this situation, can we actually expect a lot more from them?
Well, I think in these situations you operate on interests rather than principles. Russia can do this because it can and it will. And as I said, I think the West has already made up its mind that Crimea is a lost cause. And now they're thinking, what can we do to contain this without resulting in awful economic consequences for us and try to reach a kind of compromise with Russia? We can't deny its power.
Alessia, what's your conclusion?
Well, I think that the jury is still out. That for the time being, what seems to be an obvious situation of trying to save our inability to do something more is perhaps it could be seen the other sort of the opposite way. It is a very articulated, cautious situation because we have interest to lose. But at the same time, there is a lot to go in terms of the politics of the evolution of the situation.
Alessia Batalano and Daniela Pellet, unfortunately we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
Vanuit Londen, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦,这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
There is plenty more to come on the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world, Gina Rossiter, who is in Rio de Janeiro, and Mike Lee of Jazz Wise magazine will also join me for our weekly music review at the end of the program. But before we get started on that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the world news headlines.
Thank you very much. The US Secretary of State John Kerry, who's just arrived in Kiev, has condemned Russia's act of aggression in Ukraine and said Moscow, which has taken control of the Crimea region, was looking for a pretext to invade more of the country. Day two of the Paralympian Oscar Pistorius's murder trial adjourned on Tuesday at the Pretoria High Court in South Africa, which saw more dramatic scenes in court and three witnesses testify. The judge sharply warned the media to behave after a local television station leaked a photograph of one of the witnesses. China beefed up security on Tuesday ahead of the country's annual National People's Congress in the wake of the knife attack in Kunming that killed dozens and injured over 100. Security was high in the capital, Beijing, for the National People's Congress parliament session. And the Egyptian foreign minister, Nabil Fahmy, has reaffirmed his country's support on Tuesday for reconciliation between rival Palestinian factions after a court banned all Hamas activities in Egypt. And that's the news for the moment here on Monaco 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time is 22:32 in Moscow. It is 18:32 here in London and 15:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It is time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we head to Rio de Janeiro. Where the annual carnival draws to a close today and the country marks 100 days until the start of the World Cup. A short while ago, I spoke to Gina Rossiter, Monocle's correspondent in Rio.
The Rio de Janeiro beaches in Copacabana and Ipanema are still bustling with so many tourists here on the scorching hot carnival day. There's an estimated about 2 million people came from other parts of Brazil, within Rio itself, and around the world to enjoy Rio de Janeiro carnival, both at the Sambadrome, where the traditional parade happens, and at the Blocos, the street party itself. Just to kind of give you an idea of how busy carnival has been here, there's one bloco in particular that happened yesterday. It was called Sargento Pimenta, or Sergeant Pepper in English, which attracted 125,000 people just to this one street party. That number, the number of people in attendance at that street party, has grown 2,400% over the past few years since 2011. Now, this street party is kind of special, and the reason why it attracts so many people is because it plays Beatles music, but with a carnival type of theme, so you still got the samba drums going into the mix. But of course, having parties like this aren't exactly cheap. Just for this one block party itself, 65,000 reais had to be invested into the stage infrastructure and the whole area, and they had to increase the number of speakers from 62 last year to 112 this year in order just to, you know, blast this Beatles music throughout the streets in Atejo de Flamengo in the south zone here of Rio de Janeiro.
That sounds amazing, and obviously during the carnival there is also the aspect of competition. What does it look like now?
Yes, so over at the Sambadrone in the north side of the city, things haven't always been pretty for not all of the Samba schools that have been competing in that. So far, we don't know the results. We're going to get the results tomorrow to see which one it took the top spot. Of course, Salgueiro is the one that's looking to come out on top. But poor Villa Isabel, that was a school that was a reigning champion last year with the famous drum queen Sabrina Sato. And half of their costumes didn't actually arrive this year. So in certain sections of the parades, they were using bathing suit bottoms instead of their actual costume. And another section of the Villa Isabel parade, their costumes didn't arrive at all. Of course, if that was somebody trying to botch the results and make it sure they didn't become a champion second year in a row, that is a possibility. But of course, as far as they're concerned, it's very disappointing for that school because they prepared for this for the whole year, only for their costumes not to arrive at the last minute.
Well, another controversial topic in Brazil today marks 100 days until the 2014 World Cup kicks off there. What is the general mood at the moment?
So, well, here in Rio de Janeiro in particular, things are looking quite happy, but I think that's a mixture that today is just the last day of carnival, so people are more happy-go-lucky than usual this time of year anyway. Of course, FIFA's president, Sepp Blatter, he has released a statement to the public in various different languages, and he basically has said that it's 100 days leading up to the World Cup, and if you're not ready and if there are problems, then that's going to feel like not a lot of time. But of course, he's saying that the problems have been solved and that that is a fair amount of time and that everything is basically running smoothly. Brazil has been plagued with various problems. Stadiums have been delivered late in various cities, and then other infrastructure projects like transport links and so on have been delivered either late or won't be ready at all, which is definitely concerning considering Brazil will be hosting 600,000 tourists from abroad, and then 3 million from within Brazil will be traveling throughout the country to see these games during the month tournament.
Sheena, just quickly, let's finish with good news from Brazil. Brazil's economy grew twice the expected rate last year.
Yes, exactly. So the recent results show that the economy has grown at double the rate. Last quarter, it grew 0.07% GDP. And last year in total, it was 2.3%. This has been in thanks to increased consumer spending and investment. In fact, the finance minister himself, Guido Mantega, said that he was even surprised that this was a surprise for the government, this growth rate which Brazil has experienced in the last year. The one disappointing area, though, was agriculture. Agriculture shrunk 0.2%, which is a big shock considering in the past few years, Brazil has been one of the main soybean crop traders with China. Of course, there has been speculation by some economists that Brazil is relying too much on this trade that it's having with China and that it's becoming overly dependent on that trade. The fact that China had a so-called soft landing in recent years, growing at a still excellent rate, although a lot slower than before. So economists are worried that Brazil should not be depending too much on that. Inflation has been still quite high in Brazil, hitting the range between 5 and 6%, and interest rates have still remained some of the highest in the world at 10.75%. All of this, though, the fact that the economy is growing and that it's growing higher than the government has expected is great news for President Dilma Rousseff. She's seeking re-election in the October federal elections, and this will be her second term in office if she does win. So far, things are looking more positive for Dilma, and this latest news on a higher growth rate in the economy is just great news and will keep her popularity positive in the polls as we lead up to those elections.
That was Sheena Rossiter, Monocle's correspondent in Rio, speaking to me a short while ago. Up next, we'll be looking at the ways the market for photography has changed during the last 20 years. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms. which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. This week, London's renowned Atlas Gallery, dedicated for fine art photography, celebrates its 20th anniversary. A new exhibition that opens on Thursday will go through the best work exhibited there, including an exhibition that was staged in Antarctica. To discuss the history of this gallery and how the market for photography has changed over the past 20 years, I'm delighted to say that Ben Burdett of the Atlas Gallery joins me live in the studio now. Welcome to the program, Ben. When you look at what the situation was 20 years ago when you launched this gallery, how has the market for photography changed during all those years?
Well, I guess it's changed with society and with the art market generally. Photography isn't really, just an art form in a bubble, if you like. It's part of the global art world, and that has changed immeasurably in the last 20 years. It's become a kind of fully developed industry, a consumer business with many different areas and lots of advice, lots of different places to buy, museum shows, all kinds of things. So it's changed a lot.
So it sounds like that is reflected both in how much we appreciate photography as an art form and probably also in the prices.
Prices have definitely gone up, yes. I think the big difference from when I first began, which was even more than 20 years ago, I should add, was that when I first began, the market for contemporary art wasn't nearly as complex and sophisticated as it is today, and the market for photography was then very much a connoisseur field, focused largely on more kind of antiquarian, early vintage photography rather than the contemporary art world part of the photography market that is so popular today.
Atlas Gallery deals both with vintage and contemporary photography. Do you see these different fields attracting different kind of buyers as well?
They definitely do. I mean, they're sort of distinct fields, but it doesn't mean that you don't get the same collectors, the same buyers buying in both areas, but they kind of attract slightly different people. The field of vintage or early 20th century or even modernist photography demands a certain higher level of sort of connoisseurship. There are a few more complex issues to do with dating of prints, the provenance, the condition, those sorts of things, which requires a little bit more kind of study and scholarship in comparison to contemporary works, which in some ways are kind of, you know, more direct. They kind of attract slightly more kind of a slightly different buyer who's buying something for slightly different reasons.
When we look at where those testosterone dollars go, which kind of works are the most wanted ones for big money?
For big money, you know, who knows? Because records are set all the time. Some very high prices have been recorded over the last sort of 10 years for both modernist works and contemporary works. I think the biggest prices over the last 5 years are for Andreas Gursky, who I think occupies two of the top slots in the top five. Although so there's some very high prices paid for mid-20th century American photographers. Edward Weston, Edward Steichen, regularly sell for over $2 million.
When you think of those 20 years you've been working with Atlas Gallery, what have been the highlights? Say, people you've been working with, specific exhibitions. What are your top memories?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the show that we have opening on Thursday is called Collected Works. And the sort of clue is in the title there. The exhibition is largely a selection of works that have been the most collected. That's to say, the works that have sold the most or been sought after most by our clients. Having said that, there are plenty of works that haven't sold. So, you know, it's a kind of a survey of a lot of things that we've had the sort of pleasure and honor to be able to handle, and we've worked with a lot of great photographers and some amazing people.
So tell me about this exhibition that is opening on Thursday. What exactly is included there?
It includes a slightly eclectic selection of works, but in many ways, it's a sort of survey of 20th century and some contemporary photography with some very, very well-known images, but then a couple of sort of slightly more eclectic pieces. There's work by Cartier-Bresson, by Salgado, by Paul Strand, by many of the big names of 20th century photography, but then there are some contemporary names like Cindy Sherman and some other more emerging artists as well. We've started working recently with a number of Scandinavian photographers, young contemporary photographers whose work's on show also.
You mentioned in the beginning of this discussion that when you look at the past 20 years, you have easily seen how the photography market has matured and become more sophisticated. When you look at these things globally now, what at the moment, what are the sensors for, say, photography markets in the world?
The centres really are, you know, still the centres of the art world in general. It's London, Paris, Hong Kong's become a very big focal point for the Far East, and Miami obviously recently has become a major centre with the art fair in December, which is a major gathering. But I think that's the interesting thing about the art world. It is the art buying community around the world. It is a truly global community, but with only a relatively small number of focal points to focus their buying on.
Ben Burdus of the Atlas Gallery, thank you very much for this. Here on Midori House, we continue now with a bit of music. Lo Fang's debut album Blue Film was released at the end of February and has already been touted as the breakthrough album of the year. This is the first track of the record and it's called When We Are Fire. That was When We Are Fire by Lo Fang. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We are fast approaching the end of the program, but before we go, time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. And today it's turn for music. My guest is Mike Flynn, Deputy Editor of Jazz Wise magazine. Welcome to the program.
Good evening. Great to be here.
Good evening. So when we look at the jazz world in the year 2014. What have the last 2 months been like for you and for that music?
Yeah, well, it's actually got off to a great start, actually. I mean, I hate to have chosen three tracks from artists that are actually in the latest Jazzwise magazine, but actually we've got off to a flying start with three, you know, like at least half a dozen great albums already this year. We've had Pat Metheny's brought out a new band called the Unity Group. We've got this great band Snarky Puppy coming up, who have just won a Grammy. And yeah, it's been a good year so far.
You have indeed brought with you three tracks that we're going to be hearing short clips of. And first of all, I have to ask, what's going on with all the covers? At least two of three are actually cover versions.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, covers in the pop world, you can't move for covers. I mean, that's just been, you know, and unfortunately the 80s still tends to dominate things, which is kind of a sad thing. But I think what the jazz artists are doing is actually finding new standards. You know, it's something that Herbie Hancock actually pioneered back in the 90s, taking songs by Nirvana and Prince and actually turning them into jazz songs. And so, you know, the first song we're going to hear by Christine Tobin, her whole album is a kind of like a homage and a study of Leonard Cohen's music, and it's absolutely stunningly beautiful.
Let's listen to that one song from her now. This is called Everybody Knows.
Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got that sinking feeling like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. And everybody knows.
Oh, I like that. That was called Everybody Knows. It was by Christine Tobin, and actually it was a cover of a Leonard Cohen song. What can you tell us about this artist?
Well, Christine has been around the UK scene for almost 20 years, actually, and she's done a huge variety of work. And, you know, really, because she's not sort of a really demonstrative singer, she's not a big kind of soul singer, she tends to be a lot more subtle. She's got an absolutely beautiful voice, and there's a strong element of folk in her music, you know?
I was just saying, you mentioned her voice. I really liked what I heard, and what I'm wondering over here at the moment is that I'm not from the UK and I haven't actually heard of her elsewhere. Why is she not more known globally?
It's an extremely good question. I mean, she's just been kind of getting a lot more sort of awards acknowledgement. She won a Herald Angel Award at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival last year, and also a composing award a few months before that. And really, I mean, this album is kind of hopefully going to tip the balance. I mean, she performed at the Rochester Jazz Festival in New York a year ago, I believe, and, you know, had a great reaction. And she really does deserve to a lot more international recognition. She's an absolutely brilliant artist.
So Christine Tobin is the name, check that. Next artist, or actually next group, is called Michael Wolny Trio. What can you tell us about this?
Well, Michael, I'll have to correct your pronunciation. It's Wolny.
I got it wrong.
That's okay. He's from Germany, and actually, you know, he's basically being seen as the next big jazz star in Germany. His album is actually flying off the shelves over there, and he's had a band called M, literally spelled EM, that are now kind of on hiatus. They've all had kids, and he's had a kid as well. But actually, this album is a really different album. This is a Flaming Lips song we're going to hear, but they actually finish with a Pink song, redone, God is a DJ, completely redone in a really different way. But lots of other things, you know, Shostakovich, some blues, gothic themes, you know, romantic classical themes, all sorts of interesting stuff in there.
Let's listen to some music. So this is indeed from the album Weltentraum, and the name of the track is Be Free Away. So the name of that song was Be Free Away, and Mike, you can introduce the act, you pronounce the name better.
Michael Wolny Trio from Germany, absolutely wonderful stuff.
We still have time for one more clip, let's listen to it straight away. This is Snarky Puppy with Lingers.
Lingers.
What a great song to finish with. What can you tell us about this?
Snarky Puppy, I mean, basically they've been going 10 years. They've just won a Grammy for a song that they did with Layla Hathaway. But actually, this is from their new album. It's called We Like It Here. And the reason it's called We Like It Here is because they're from America. They came to Europe. They've had massive success over here. And they like it so much, they called the album We Like It Here. They're basically from Brooklyn, led by a great bass player called Michael League. And if you get a chance to see them live, go and do it. They are incredible.
Exactly, that's definitely a group we're going to be hearing more of in the future. Mike Flynn, Deputy Editor of Jazzwise Magazine, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Pleasure.
And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Daniela Pellet of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Alessia Batalano of King's College London. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Christy Roma, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next after the news is Section D with Monocle's design editor Tom Morris. Then at 2200 hours London time, it's turn for the Monocle Daily with Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.